Lecture 11. Buddhism in China.
As we continue to survey the development of Buddhism in Asia, it's time finally, I think, to turn our attention to China. By the time Buddhism entered Tibet, there had been Buddhists in China for over 500 years. In this lecture, we'll consider the process of transformation that took place as the first few generations of Chinese Buddhists struggled to understand the significance of this foreign tradition and adapt it to the distinctive needs of Chinese culture and the Chinese people. When the first Buddhist monks began to appear in the Chinese capital in the middle of the second century of the Common Era, that's pretty early, I think we can remind ourselves, in the history of Buddhism. You remember, perhaps, that the Mahayana tradition only began to emerge in Indian Buddhism right around the beginning of the Common Era. So when Buddhist monks began to make their way into China in the middle of the second century of the Common Era, the Mahayana was just beginning to flourish in some form in the Indian tradition. At this time, in the second century of the Common Era, China was coming to the end of one of the most prosperous eras in its history. During the Han Dynasty that lasted from 206 BCE to 220 CE, China was stable culturally and stable politically. The prosperity of Han China was closely tied to an ideological synthesis that we now refer to as Han Confucianism, a tradition that was derived from the teaching of the sage Confucius, who lived about 500 years or so before the Common Era. Starting from the teaching of Confucius, scholars had created a vision of heaven, earth, family, and human society all existing together as a single harmonious whole. Now, I am far from being a scholar of Confucianism, so I can't comment to you in any kind of authoritative way about this tradition, but I don't think it's unfair to say that the key values for Confucian people, for scholars, and also for Confucian bureaucrats and for the common people who made up Confucian society in China, the key values were harmony, respect for elders, as we say, piety or respect for elders, and a sense that society was bound together by the proper performance of ritual. And this particular Confucian concept I've always found difficult to speak to my students about in the classroom at Boston University, because you know 17 and 18 and 19-year-old students are not particularly respectful of precise performance of ritual behavior. And to get some sense of why ritual was significant for the Confucian tradition and why it might actually be considered a value that would tie society together, we often do a simple experiment of shaking hands to get and imagining ourselves in a social role where greeting somebody by shaking hands might actually convey some very important information to them about yourself and about your sense of respect for them. So I ask everybody to stand up and find a neighbor, and then imagine that they're going for a job interview or going to meet somebody important, and simply hold their hand out and greet the other person and sense what the best way is to establish some sense of mutual respect and social connection with that other person. It's very easy to see in a practical setting how simple rituals like that can have profound social effect. You can convey an enormous amount of information to somebody about your sense of self and your sense of them simply by the way you reach out, grasp their hand, and establish that basic form of social contact. The Confucian vision of society was really of a very large structure of social interaction tied together by rituals of that sort, not just the small rituals like shaking hands, but the much larger rituals that the emperor would perform from time to time to establish the connection between human beings and the cosmos, the rituals that are performed to tie a family together or a community together or whatever. All of these ritual actions bound the world of Chinese civilization together into a harmonious pattern. Now, this vision of the world was obviously very effective in stable and prosperous times, but as the Han Dynasty began to disintegrate, the system of Confucian values began to fall apart with the decline of the dynasty, and people began to look around for other kinds of values that they could use to deal with the challenges of ordinary human life. In the middle of the 2nd century, the Han synthesis did indeed begin to fall apart. The emperor came under the influence of rival factions in the court and no longer had the power or the moral authority to guarantee the legitimacy of the state. And as factions struggled for power, the peasants were increasingly alienated and oppressed, and intellectuals, the kind of people to whom Buddhist monks would normally begin to preach their new teaching, looked for new ways to diagnose and respond to the moral difficulties of the time. And I think you'd have to say that China was really ripe in this period, at the end of the 2nd century of the Common Era, for the introduction of new ideas, even ideas as foreign and as fundamentally strange as the teaching of the Buddha, imported through Central Asia from India. Buddhism, truth be told, had a long way to go before it could become a major part of Chinese civilization. As Buddhist monks made their way into China, coming across the Silk Road through Central Asia, they began to try to communicate Buddhist ideas in a Chinese way, they faced some barriers that I think are pretty easy for us to understand. Sanskrit and Chinese, simply as languages, were radically different, and they expressed radically different systems of thought. So the kind of philosophy that would be natural to articulate in a Sanskrit medium, the kind of philosophy that we've been talking about in at least some of our lectures in earlier segments of this course, simply doesn't translate well into the Chinese language and to Chinese patterns of thinking. And a key difference between Indian civilization and particularly between Buddhism and Chinese social values has to do with Chinese emphasis on the family. The family is really the center for many people, the articulation and practice of Confucian values. In Buddhism, the emphasis, the major emphasis, is really on rejection of the family. Just looking back at the story of the Buddha himself, the crucial moment in his early life came when he left behind his wife and his young child and joined a group of wandering monks in the forest. This would be a very strange idea to the Chinese. So the Buddhists had to overcome some barriers before they could begin to express Buddhism in a way that would be attractive in Chinese civilization. One of the strategies they used to make this adaptation was to match Sanskrit and Chinese terms, to find suitable terms in Chinese that could be used to translate Sanskrit words. They weren't always great translations, but at least they allowed people to make a certain kind of intuitive connection. For example, the word dharma, such an important word in traditional Buddhism, the word that we use to name the Buddha's teaching, was matched with the Chinese word dao, that means simply the way. So the dharma became the way, like the way of Confucius, or the way, as we'll see in a few moments, of the Taoist tradition. Often, Buddhist monks simply omitted offensive concepts, and they left out aspects of the Indian tradition that were particularly uncongenial to Chinese tastes, such as the renunciation of the family. They emphasized images drawn from the Mahayana sutras that the Chinese might instinctively resonate with, like the image of the Bodhisattva Vimalakirti, who was a great Buddhist sage, but also lived at home with his family and lived active social life in the ordinary lay context. So by some shrewd concept matching and also by being rather selective about the things that they presented to the Chinese, they began to make some initial connections. But they were only able to dig more deeply into their contact with Chinese culture when they began to plumb the relationship with the indigenous Chinese religious tradition known as Taoism. They sensed, I think quite rightly, that there was a particular kinship between Indian Buddhist values and the values of this great Chinese tradition. Taoism was comparable in antiquity to Confucianism, but in contrast to the active public virtues of Confucianism, Taoism advocated a strategy of inactivity and contemplation. How wonderful. You can imagine how attractive this would have seemed to a Buddhist monk encountering Chinese civilization for the first time. The Taoist way, or the Tao, was down to earth. It was natural. It had to do with a harmonious relationship with the movements of the natural world. It emphasized the value of harmony, as the Confucian tradition did. And the Taoist way was inexpressible in words, much like the Buddhist concept of nirvana or the Buddhist concept of emptiness. We can see the kinship between Taoism and Buddhism by looking at a few passages from the Tao Te Ching, one of the fundamental texts of the Taoist tradition. The very first verse emphasizes the inexpressibility of the Tao. The Tao that can be told of is not the eternal Tao. The name that can be named is not the eternal name. The nameless is the origin of heaven and earth. The named is the mother of all things. Remember Vimalakirti's silence, how they questioned Vimalakirti about the so-called Dharma door of non-duality, and the most profound response to that question was Vimalakirti's refusal to say anything at all. How marvelous to put that story in juxtaposition with this opening chapter of the Tao Te Ching. The two seem to be working with language in very similar ways. It seems to suggest to us that we can make some more profound connections between these two traditions. Another verse speaks about emptiness in a way that would be very congenial to Mahayana philosophers. The Tao is empty like a bowl. It may be used, but its capacity is never exhausted. It is bottomless. Perhaps it's the ancestor of things. It blunts its sharpness. It unties tangles. It softens its light. It becomes one with the dusty world. You remember how difficult it was for us to talk about emptiness here together. It's a very problematic concept, especially when it's expressed in abstract form. But here in the Tao Te Ching, in these Taoist scriptures, we have a very concrete, very down-to-earth image of emptiness as an empty bowl out of which all things come and can never be exhausted. A very rich, poetic image of the positive dimension of the emptiness concept, potentially, in the Mahayana tradition. Here's another vision of emptiness as a source of power and effectiveness and activity. 30 spokes are united around the hub to make a wheel, but it's on its non-being that the utility of the carriage depends. It's on the empty space at the hub of the wheel that the effectiveness of the carriage revolves. Clay is molded to form a utensil, but it's on its non-being that the utility of the utensil depends. Doors and windows are cut out to make a room, but it's on its non-being that the utility of the room depends. Therefore, turn being to advantage and turn non-being into utility. We've struggled often in our lectures, in this course to try to get some sense of the positive resonance of the image of non-being, of no self, of emptiness in the Buddhist tradition. Here we're encountering a Chinese tradition that reveres images of negativity in the same way. Non-being here is a very positive way of viewing something like the source of potentiality, the place out of which utility arises in the flow of ordinary experience. We can imagine how Buddhists, with their reverence for simplicity, renunciation, and emptiness, would have been delighted to hear these words. In the hard times that followed the fall of the Han Dynasty, Taoism offered an effective survival strategy for the beleaguered intelligentsia. It also, not incidentally, offered a very rich body of words and ideas to express Buddhism in a Chinese way, and it helped the Chinese intellectuals listen to Buddhist teaching with receptive ears. While the connection with Taoism offered Buddhists an important cultural opportunity, I think we also have to acknowledge that it changed Buddhist values in important ways as well. Buddhism had to become more pragmatic and down to earth in order to exploit this connection with Taoism. Taoism certainly had a philosophical side, as Buddhism did, but it had nothing as elaborate as the Indian analysis, for example, of the five components of the personality, and certainly nothing as intense analytically as the philosophical exploration of the emptiness doctrine in India. So Buddhism had to find ways to express itself that were more down to earth, more pragmatic, more concerned with experience in this world. Nature became an important concept in Chinese Buddhism as it had never been in India, because the Tao is associated with the movements of the natural world, and it was often found in Chinese experience by withdrawing into a natural environment. And Buddhism had to become much more amenable to the possibility of a sudden experience of enlightenment. Chinese tradition wasn't particularly concerned, at least initially, with seeking some kind of salvation that was outside of this world. Salvation or transformation or awakening or whatever it was you were seeking came here, suddenly, in the experience of this world. So all of these values were absorbed by the Buddhist tradition and transformed Mahayana Buddhism in significant ways. These influences became clear, finally, in Chinese history during the Tang Dynasty, which lasted from the year 618 to 907, when Buddhism became the dominant religious tradition in China. The Tang Dynasty saw the development of several important Buddhist schools, including the meditation school known in China as Chan and in Japan as Zen. The Chan school is traced historically to a legendary Indian saint by the name of Bodhidharma, who flourished, according to the tradition, from around 460 to 534. And it began to take on a distinctively Chinese character in the hands of a Chan master by the name of Hong Zhen, and then finally in the hands of his disciples, Shen Shu and Hui Neng, who lived at the end of the 7th century and at the beginning of the 8th. One version of the conflict, if that's the right word, between these two disciples is found in the Platform Sutra of the 6th Patriarch, a text that is associated with Hui Neng, who was known retrospectively as the 6th Patriarch. Hui Neng, in this text, advocated a position of sudden awakening, while Shen Shu advocated gradual awakening. Let me tell you what this means. Those are those terms may come to you simply like words scratched on a blackboard. It would be a good idea to have a story here to try to put some of this in context. And happily, the Chan tradition out of which these two figures come is rich in marvelous stories of experiences of sudden awakening. The story of Huainong goes something like this. He is an illiterate figure from the provinces who comes to the monastery to seek teaching about awakening. The master challenges him and says, you know, who are you? Where do you come from? He says, I come from some provincial region. And the master says, well, we really can't teach a barbarian like you. And Huainong says to the master, well, there is no north or south in the Buddha nature. Why should there be north or south in the choosing of a disciple to hear the teaching? The master receives him, allows him to become a student in the monastery, and then sends him out to do some menial labor. In the meantime, he schedules a competition, a verse competition, to decide who will receive the mantle of his authority in the next generation. Students are challenged to write a verse that expresses their understanding of awakening. So Shenshu, the lead monk in the monastery, the A student, you might say, writes a verse that goes like this. The body is the tree of perfect wisdom. The mind is the stand of a bright mirror. At all times, diligently wipe it. Do not allow it to become dusty. Classic statement about the diligent practice of meditation that would lead you to some kind of awakening. Huainong heard about this verse and dictated a response of his own. It goes like this. Fundamentally, perfect wisdom has no tree, nor has the bright mirror any stand. Buddha nature is forever clear and pure. Where is there any dust? Classic statement about emptiness. You remember when we were talking about emptiness just a couple of lectures ago, I said that if you take the doctrine of non-duality or the understanding of emptiness as non-duality literally, there is no barrier between us at this moment and the Buddha. Well, here Huainong is making precisely that assertion. Fundamentally, perfect wisdom has no tree, nor has the bright mirror any stand, the mirror of the mind. Buddha nature is forever clear and pure. Where is there any dust? Why is there any need to engage in some kind of diligent practice to seek awakening, as if awakening were something different from the experience of the present moment? This love of paradox and stress on sudden enlightenment has characterized the Chan tradition from that day to this. It has a remarkable distrust of words. It loves paradoxical expression, and it emphasizes direct person-to-person transmission of insight in much the same way that the Taoist tradition did in classical China. Now, the Chan school was not the only form of Mahayana Buddhism to develop in this period. There were other philosophical schools as well, and there also were devotional traditions that were significant in the spread of Buddhism in China. For peasants and villagers, the promise of salvation in Amitabha's pure land held out hope for a happy future life. And for the elite, it often offered a type of contemplation that was very different from the austere practice of Chan. One place to see this is in the words of a Chinese Pure Land teacher by the name of Tao Cho. Suppose a man in an empty and distant place encounters a bandit who, drawing his sword, comes forcefully and directly to kill him. This man runs straight on and, looking ahead, crosses a river. So also does the practitioner. When he is contemplating Amita or Amitabha Buddha, he is like the man contemplating the crossing. The thought is continuous, no others being mingled with it. This is a teaching here of single-minded, intense, focused contemplation on the figure of Amida and the aspera of Amitabha, Buddha, and the possibility of rebirth in the Pure Land. For many people also, the cult of celestial bodhisattvas, such as Avalokiteshvara, or as Avalokiteshvara is called in China, Guanyin, promised not just rebirth in another world, but direct assistance with the problems of this life, such as the birth of a child or prosperity in the family. I think I mentioned to you when we were talking about celestial bodhisattvas and Buddhas a few lectures ago that I made a visit not so long ago, a couple of years ago, to a pilgrimage site on an island off the coast of southern China that's sacred to the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, or Guanyin. And it's remarkable to see how lively the cult of Guanyin is today in China. People come from all over China and from many parts of the overseas Chinese community to invoke the aid of Guanyin for prosperity in the family, and also do the other things that have to do with the practice of Buddhist pilgrimage, moving from shrine to shrine, carrying incense bags where you get the incense bag stamped with an amulet that will in some way be used to assure your passage into a good rebirth in the next life, and also visit a cave that's referred to as the Cave of Tidal Sound, where people traditionally have sought visions of the Bodhisattva Guanyin. So the devotional traditions of the Mahayana that were so important to the spread of the Mahayana in India also played a tremendously significant role in the spread of Mahayana Buddhism in China. Buddhist values also had broad influence during the Tang Dynasty and in later periods on Chinese literature and the arts. One of my favorite Chinese Buddhist poets is a figure who is known simply as Cold Mountain, Han Shan. He wrote some of the Buddhist tradition's finest contemplative verses about nature. You get a sense in his verses of the transformation that's taken place in Buddhism as it begins to absorb some of the Taoist respect for the natural world. "As for me," he says, "I delight in the everyday way. Among mist-wrapped vines and rocky caves, here in the wilderness I am completely free. With my friends, the white clouds, idling forever. There are roads, but they do not reach the world. Since I am mindless, who can rouse my thoughts? On a bed of stone I sit, alone in the night, while the round moon climbs up Cold Mountain." When we talk about this poem in my classes on Buddhism at Boston University, I often challenge students to sit down with a piece of paper and just jot down the elements of this poem that remind them of Indian Buddhism, and then jot down the elements that remind them of Chinese Taoism, and then try to identify the ways these elements have been fused in the mind of the poet to bring these two traditions together into a single aesthetic unity. I think you could say from the Indian point of view that we have here a classic image of the solitary wanderer, just like the solitary wandering sage of the Buddha as he made his way across the roads of northern India. There's an image of freedom. Nirvana, above all, for Indian Buddhists, is an experience of freedom. This freedom is beyond the world. The world, I suppose, we could understand as a way of designating samsara, the realm of death and rebirth. And the moon that's referred to in the last line is a classic old Indian symbol for the coolness, for the quiet of the Buddha. There was a tradition in India, actually, that the rays of the moon cooled you if you slept outside at night, in the same way that the rays of the sun warm you during the daytime. So the coolness of the Buddha's contemplation is associated with the moon. All of these are Indian resonances in this poem. Chinese resonances, where would we look for those? The idea that the poet has become unified with nature, settled into a natural setting in order to experience his awakening and become a sage. The idea of the everyday way, the Tao, that is associated with everyday and everyday common experiences, that down-to-earth, pragmatic image of the way, comes very much, very strongly from the Taoist tradition. When he says, "I am mindless," he's referring to a Taoist line in which the sage is viewed as having no mind of his own, but simply absorbing himself in the natural world. All of these are Chinese resonances, and yet you can see how the two traditions also have been so closely merged that it's very difficult in the end to pull them apart. So I think we can say that although it took many centuries, the Buddhist tradition went through a remarkable period of transformation in China, in which it shaped itself from a tradition that was radically different from anything that the Chinese would ever find acceptable, to a tradition that had become very deeply merged with the ancient wisdom of Chinese culture, and in the process transformed the Buddhist tradition itself profoundly.